You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Shirei Zhang toku ingoa. No mai, haere mai, ki te wire mō tēnā rā. Kia ora, welcome to the first Wire of 2020. Today is Dahina Monday, the 13th of January. I'm sure your host, and I'm in studio with my producer, Deb.
Hello.
Hello, Deb. Well,
it feels very empty without Louis here.
I know. Poor Louis's been dragged off to Tuesday, so you'll hear him from tomorrow. So how's your New Year's, Deb?
It was good. Kind of funny you're asking me, considering
really?
we were together.
We spent New Year's together in Australia, actually. Mm. Yeah, so it was a good time.
It was great, yeah. It felt kind of strange to be there enjoying our holiday while the fires were happening.
Yeah, yeah. So we'll hear from our mate Gemma in a bit later. We catch up with her. Yeah, let me just dive right in. Coming up on the show today, we've got our weekly chat with Green Party co-leader James Shaw. We talk about five, carbon emissions, trading scheme and climate change education in schools. And as I hinted before, we catch up with Adelaide freelance writer and journalist Gemma Finn on the Australian bushfires and climate change protests. And Deb, what do you talk about? Well, I've got it actually written here. You know what? I'll read it out. Okay. Deb talks to playwright Stanley Mukawe about his new play, Black Lover, which is about a New Zealand expat who became Prime Minister in Rhodesia, which is now known as Zimbabwe. E aha o whakaro, if you have any thoughts to share throughout the show, we'd love to hear from you. And tuki pātui mai, send through a text through to 5395, or wire mai, you can call us in studio to chat with us on 309 3879.
It's time to hear from the Green Party with co-leader James Shaw.
We are back with our weekly chat with Green Party co-leader James Shaw. The Minister attended the Climate Change Conference in Madrid, so we catch up on how the conference went. We also talk about the proposed changes to the carbon emissions trading schemes and then the rollout of the climate change education in schools. I begin by asking him on how COP25 in Madrid was.
The thing about these conferences is that there are what we're kind of trying to do here is to create almost a system for governance that covers every country, right, in terms of how we're going to behave and trade issues and issues to do with human rights and indigenous rights and all sorts of things as relates to climate change and the effect that climate change has on people, but also how we respond to it, what technologies we use, the kinds of systems for how communities can adapt, issues particularly to do with financial support for developing countries. That's a really big hurdle. So it's a really complicated system, but there was really one big thing that was the fly in the ointment for this most recent conference. And that was what they call Article 6, which is the last chapter of the Paris Agreement that didn't get agreed the previous year in terms of, you know, what do the rules look like for how countries cooperate and whether there's going to be a global system for carbon markets like there used to be. And of course the problem is, under the old system, you might remember there was what they called the hot air scandal. There were all of these fraudulent credits, particularly from the Ukraine and Russia, that didn't actually represent any real reduction in emissions that were going into the system. And a lot of countries, including New Zealand, got quite badly burnt by that. And we don't want to see a repeat of that happening. And the problem is that there is a group of countries that want a very permissive rule set that would allow a repeat of that kind of behaviour that we saw about 10 years ago. And there's no way that's going to be allowed to happen for a number of other countries. And so that was sort of the impasse that got reached. And then the problem was that kind of infected all of the other areas of the conference, because, you know, the countries that wanted the more permissive rule set saying, well, look, we're not going to let progress happen on these other fronts until we get what we want in terms of carbon markets. Countries that want environmental integrity and transparency and saying, well, okay, that's just too bad then.
Because there were, you know, fair amount of criticism that not much was perhaps done in this last conference. So, yeah.
There wasn't. I fall quite firmly into the camp that says that no deal was better than a bad deal. Because we actually saw the consequences of a bad deal under the old, what they call the Kyoto system. And, you know, like I said, New Zealand was one of the countries that got quite badly burned by that, and we don't want to see a repeat of that happening. And our focus now is on reducing our domestic greenhouse gas emissions. That should be the focus that every country has. And so I think, frankly, I think we can afford to take our time on the international markets piece to get it right.
Mm. What are you hoping will happen next year's conference, Sam?
Well, I guess I hope that those countries that were seeking a more permissive rule set will realise that it's not in their interests to continue to hold out, and that we eventually get that over the line. I mean, that's kind of the practical piece. But next year's conference is significant because it's the first year that the Paris Agreement takes effect, 2020, and so symbolically it's important. I know that the United Nations Secretary General is making a huge push on getting countries to raise their ambition in terms of their goals for reducing greenhouse gases, because at the moment, the level of commitments that were made when the Paris Agreement was first signed up to do not get us on that pathway towards staying within 1.5 degrees. In fact, we're quite badly off course for that. So we're looking at about 3 or 4 degrees of global warming with current levels of commitment.
Because understandable, you know, reasoning behind bad deal is not worth it, but I guess people are frustrated because the effects of climate change are being felt. And
that's right.
Yeah, right now. So
yeah, they are, but the rest of the Paris Agreement still takes effect. I mean, that's the thing, is that we do have this global agreement, and it does, we've got kind of rules that cover every single aspect of it other than this one section. And so we can get going, and we desperately need to get going, not just around the world, but also here in New Zealand.
Another point of criticism I wanted to bring up was Keta Sherwood O'Regan was really critical that Pacifica and Indigenous communities, you know, felt left out of the conference. Was that something you felt as well was apparent at the conference?
Yeah, well, the design of the conference is that the weird thing about these things, and actually there's a lot of weird things, but one of the weird things about these events is that you've got sort of two conferences in one. One is the negotiations where you've got the negotiating teams of the different countries. And then you've got this kind of parallel event, and that includes the Indigenous rights groups that Kira and a number of other New Zealanders were involved in. There's a big sort of business convention that happens. There's all the kind of global environmental NGOs and so on. And in fact, that's a larger event than the negotiating conference. And the problem is that although they happen in the same place, they don't really talk to each other. The Indigenous people's platform that Kira is involved in has been getting more and more significant over time. And they did get some wins in terms of the recognition of Indigenous people's rights in the negotiators' conference, but there's no direct interaction between the two. And so that's, I guess, the source of her frustration.
Because that lack of inclusivity is kind of concerning, given that Indigenous communities are probably going to be the most, you know, one of the most affected groups from climate change. So,
well, they are. And, I mean, we know here in New Zealand that, for a variety of reasons, Māori are, in many ways, first and most exposed to the effects of climate change. And so if that's true here in New Zealand, then you can guarantee it's true in most other former colonial countries as well. And so, you know, countries have got different levels of, I don't know how to describe this, that they approach their Indigenous populations in quite different ways. And that's sort of part of the source of the problem in the conference, is that you've got countries that want to see some progress on that, and then you've got countries that are holding out because they take a more aggressive attitude towards their own Indigenous peoples.
Moving forward next year, do you think that there will be a general trend in that, that there will be more inclusivity with Indigenous voices?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I hold out some hope in that, you know, 5 years ago there was no Indigenous persons platform at all. And there was a kind of a small side tent in the very kind of back alleys of the Paris Agreement, and that was it. And now it's got a much more kind of prominent voice, if you like, and you do see the influence that it's starting to exert over some countries' negotiating teams, and that's good. And I can see that that trend will be set to continue.
And moving on to domestically, I see that there's going to be proposed changes to the emissions trading scheme. So do you mind walking through that with me?
Yeah, sure. I mean, right before Christmas, we released a consultation document that essentially follows on from the Zero Carbon Bill last year, because the Zero Carbon Bill said, OK, well, we've got this high-level goal, which is that we want to stay within 1.5 degrees of global warming. What that means is that we've got to cap our emissions and then reduce them over time. And then the next piece of legislation that we're introducing is reforms to the emissions trading scheme to align it with those goals. And so what we've released is a discussion document that then says, OK, people, here's the reality of the situation. If we're going to hit these targets, what that means is that we need to cap emissions at 2020 levels and then reduce them fairly dramatically over the course of the coming decades. And so what we were, you know, showing is what the mathematics of that looks like for people, and then we're asking for people to kind of comment and say, you know, what they think about that. Do they want to go faster? Do they want to go slower? Mm. And what are the implications of those choices?
Will these caps be enough as an incentive? Because I was having a read through, and it seems like national road use and the manufacturing industry and then fossil fuels are the three main contributors to our carbon emissions. So are there other, you know, instead of just an economic cap, are there other alternatives as well to reducing?
There are. I mean, the emissions trading scheme has not functioned well. It's been very poorly designed to do the job it was intended to do, and we're in the middle of reforming that. So it will become a more important and more useful tool, but it is only one of the tools in the toolbox, if you like. And there are other things that we are working on that also will have an effect on greenhouse gas emissions. And so, for example, you might have seen Grant Robertson, the finance minister, at the end of last year said that he was going to spend quite a lot of money on capital projects, and that about $200 million of those dollars would go towards decarbonising the public sector, for example. So we know that the public sector agencies have got quite large car fleets, and we need to start converting those to electrics. And also schools and hospitals have got a number of coal boilers around the country, and of course they have an effect as well. And so we're going to be putting some money into replacing those.
Will we see a shift in particularly regarding around fossil fuels and electricity, and I guess the oil and gas sector? Will we see more of a shift into renewable energy?
Yes, and we already are. So the week after the Zero Carbon Bill passed through Parliament unopposed, I got a call from the head of Mercury Energy, who said that they had decided to double the size of their new wind farm outside of Palmerston North. Now, the board had, you know, they'd got consent for the full farm, but the board had said, look, you can only build half of it because we're just not sure what the policy environment's going to look like. The fact that the Zero Carbon Bill went through the House unanimously gave them the signal that they needed to double their investment. And so we're now going to get the largest wind farm in the country is about to start being built. And that's terrific news. And that's sort of a sign that shows that there is a direct connection between those pieces of legislation like the Zero Carbon Bill and the actions that companies take to decarbonise.
So is the emissions trading scheme targeting particularly specific organisations? Like predominantly, would I be correct in saying that there are a few major companies that are heavily contributing to the greenhouse gas emissions or particular industries?
There are, well, the whole idea of the emissions trading scheme is that it applies a price on carbon dioxide emissions right across the economy, wherever they occur. So if you're a big company or a small company, you should notice, you should notice that there is a price, and then you should adjust your behaviour to try and avoid that price by reducing your emissions. Mm. That's how it's supposed to work. But yes, there are companies, a number of companies, obviously, that have very high emissions. One of the pieces of work that we have to do is to work with them on what their transition plans are for them to dramatically reduce those emissions and ideally, ultimately, over the course of the coming decades, get them down to net zero.
To wrap up our chat today, I wanted to talk about the new climate change education that was just announced recently. Yeah, that's pretty exciting. It's a positive thing.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, where it came from is, so New Brighton and Christchurch is essentially on a sandbar, and it's an area that after the earthquakes there was a lot of controversy around how we rebuild the area, because it is going to be exposed to the effects of climate change through sea level rise over the course of the coming decade. So it's one of those places in the country that's particularly exposed early, before a lot of other communities are. And so it's been a real topic of conversation. So it came up in the schools and they said, well, look, we've actually got to make sure that we teach our students about the science of climate change, how we can adapt to the effects of climate change, what are the kinds of technologies we want to use to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, try and stop climate change from happening, and so on. So they've run a pilot, and it's been very successful as part of their science curriculum. And essentially what Chris Hipkins, the Education Minister, and I have done is said, okay, it's good stuff, let's roll it out to the rest of the country. Mm. And so it's going to be available for schools to use right around the country from this year.
Eco-anxiety is something that's particularly felt, I guess, in this generation and moving forward. So in terms of equipping,
yes,
yeah, I guess equipping the younger generation with life skills and a sustainable mindset, how this program supports.
Well, that I guess is where a lot of the pressure has come from via teachers, is that the teachers have been telling us that they need these kinds of resources because their students are so worried about the future. And the New Brighton pilot showed that, you know, as with most things, a bit of education is really helpful for that, because it means that people can kind of get their heads around exactly what the nature of the problem is and what needs to change in order to solve it, rather than this kind of generalized sense that something, you know, bad is happening, and that sort of sense of powerlessness that comes with not knowing what to do about it. So in that sense, I think it's a really good resource, and it's not a pure science resource in that sense. It's got pure science in it, obviously, but it is also something that should help students to sort of think through, you know, their own futures and what they can do in their own lives to sort of adapt to the effects of climate change, and also what contribution they may be interested in making to trying to stave it off.
I think it's excellent that there's a future focused program, but I guess the only worry is of climate change. You know, the effects are being felt now. We've got the Australian bushfires, we've got, you know, Pacific
yes.
Islands, they're feeling the impacts, you know, right now. So is anything being as well in terms of the education package, in terms of, I guess, current issues that are at place?
Well, I guess there's always the opportunity with these to work in current affairs and things that are happening now, both in New Zealand and around the world. And so, you know, I think most teachers would say, well, you know, here's something that's happening in the news that we know about, let's work that into it. And, of course, those stories will change over time. I mean, last year in New Zealand, of course, we had our own fires around the Nelson area. The year before that, we had the Port Hills and Christchurch, you know, and both of those, I mean, we've always, you know, like Australia, we've always had fires in New Zealand, but the scale of them changes as a result of climate change. And so those stories are happening here as well as in Australia and around the rest of the world.
That was James Shaw for the Green Party. The Wire.
We will be back after a quick break, and then we'll also be playing a song from Girl Boss called Bully.
Doctor, doctor, I've been feeling very hot all the time.
Go on.
I'm also incredibly anxious about how I look.
Well, this is very straightforward. I prescribe a Swish News summer wardrobe post-haste.
Not therapy?
Retail therapy.
Refresh your wardrobe this summer at Taddy's Designer Recycle. Take your unwanted summer clothes in now and refill your clothes rack with some breezy new threads. Taddy's Designer Recycle, 161 Ponsonby Road and 47 High Street.
Are you a real doctor?
Decalcify your pineal gland, live on broadcast radio. It's a contact lens, third eye, a pacemaker for your anahata chakra.
Rehabilitate your aura with Aaron on psychic glands. Delicate, psychedelic, transcendent, blissful.
Psychic Glands, every Thursday, 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on 95BFM, and available eternally on podcast and RSS at 95BFM.com.
At this radio station, we do our utmost to abide by the Broadcasting Standards Authority and their rules and guidelines. If you seriously think we've crossed the line on air, give us a call on 309 4831 within 20 working days of the broadcast date and tell us about it. We'll be able to help you out and tell you the procedure if you wish to make a formal complaint to the Broadcasting Standards Authority. Fuck knuckles, cock and piss. Balls. Thank you.
Safe and nice.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
You're back on Monday Wire with me, Sherry, and Deb. She's in studio with us, chilling. And so on our next story, it's about the Australian bushfires. So Kangaroo Island off the coast of Adelaide was temporarily closed over the weekend, with almost half the island burnt through by the Ravine fire, with around 170,000 hectares affected. The Victoria and New South Wales fires have also merged into a mega blaze. According to the WWF, 1.25 billion animals are dead affected by the fires. And since the fires began in September, at least 28 people have died with thousands of homes damaged. Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison has also been heavily criticised for taking a holiday while the country was affected. In total, 15 million acres have since been incinerated by the fires. Over the summer break, Deb and I visited our friend Gemma Finn in Victoria. And so Gemma is a freelance writer and journalist and is currently based in Adelaide, South Australia. I caught up with her on Sunday morning to get have an update about how the community's been with the Australian bushfires. And she also attended the climate change protest in Adelaide, which had around 3,000 people attending.
The bushfires are showing no sign of slowing down. Yesterday, Victoria and New South Wales fires joined to create a mega fire. So this has been going on for months now, and there doesn't seem to be any sight of relief. Even in Adelaide this week, our temperatures are in the 30s for the whole week, so it's pretty intense. We've seen the deaths of many people, the loss of thousands of homes and properties, the wildlife, the Australian flora and fauna that was lost. It's hard to comprehend.
Mm. Recently, I saw that Kangaroo Island was evacuated, which is pretty close to where you are at the moment. Do you have any information more on that?
Yeah. Basically, everyone in Australia knows somebody affected by these fires, whether that's directly or indirectly. So a lot of my friends and family know a lot of people from Kangaroo Island, including the two men who died from the fire, which is something Scott Morrison completely overlooked and didn't even acknowledge. But that's another story. But yeah, the Kangaroo Island fires, it's destroyed a lot of the island and caused a lot of evacuations. But it's been great to see the Australian community come together to raise money for these people. And some of my friends organised a carload of stuff and took it over to the island, including things like mattresses. So, yeah, it's been good to see everyone come together.
Mm-hmm. This is obviously very terrifying, and especially when you have people so closely affected. So how has everyone been holding up? How's the community been?
Well, we're angry. It's been beautiful in some respects. We've seen people come together. I'm sure you've seen Celeste Barber's fundraise, like $50 million for this. So it's been great in that respect. But on the other end, people are angry and we're grieving. Our entire country is on fire pretty much. And, yeah, like I said, everyone has been directly or indirectly affected by this fire. We're angry and we want change. It's just so heartbreaking to see, and you know, there's little reminders when the smoke comes across the city and you wake up one morning and can't see out your window, and it's just this rude shock that this is real, like this is happening here in our country. It's so hard to wrap your head around.
I was having a little read as well, just on updates with the fires, and I saw that another firefighter had passed away. And so... Yeah, so in terms of first responders and a lot of these are volunteer firefighters, how has that community been?
Also angry. You know, my father was a volunteer firefighter for many years. So I've done volunteer firefighting myself. I understand what fires are like, and I understand how heartbreaking it can be to see a fire destroy a property and a livelihood. But nothing that what we're seeing compares to this. It's hard to imagine exactly what everyone's feeling. But from what we're seeing in their interviews with them, and what they're saying on social media is that they're angry too. The lack of resources and support on a federal level for our firefighters is ridiculous. There's no support, and these people have been working, 15, 16-hour days for months, volunteers, a lot of them, and it's just ridiculous. Makes me angry.
Mm. A lot of people have been pretty angry at your current government and Scott Morrison, so do you mind walking me a little bit through as to why people are so frustrated with him?
There's just been a complete lack of leadership from Scott Morrison. To be honest, in my opinion, I don't care if he believes in climate change. I don't care what religion he follows. I don't care what he eats for breakfast or what he thinks about anything. But he needs to do the job that he has been employed to do, and that is to lead his country, which he is not doing. There's just been a complete lack of compassion for the people suffering. He went and visited Kangaroo Island, where two people had just died, and told the grieving community, thank God no one's died. It's just insulting that he can't even do the bare minimum. He's making Tony Abbott look like an absolute legend. He seems to be more concerned with Iran and the cricket than his own country, which is on fire, and it's just appalling. Once upon a time it was mainly, the younger generation, the hippie types who believed in climate change. But when your 70-year-old volunteer firefighters who have been on the front line for, 30 years are saying these are climate fires, step up, Scott Morrison, and do something. And he pretty much turns around and says, but the firefighters want to be there. Thank God for the cricket, hey. It's just it's a real insult to our nation. And it's showing that, even our own leader doesn't care that these people are dying, they're losing livelihoods, losing lives. And these fires, they're still going now, but the damage is going to cause in the long term, and how long it's going to take to rebuild not only, houses, but also, the physical damage, the mental damage as well. It's just, it's offensive, the lack of leadership that Scott Morrison has been showing. So in my opinion, I don't care what he thinks about climate change, but we want him to listen, we want him to learn, and we want him to lead, which is exactly what he's employed to do and what he is failing to do.
Scott Morrison has since said that it is, he does say it is from climate change. And at least, do you think that's enough, or what do you want to see from him?
I think a lot of the damage is already done with Scott Morrison, as a lot of these things needed to be thought of sooner. And I guess, in my opinion, a lot of it has been to settle the media, but that's subjective, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that Scott Morrison, obviously, no one expects him to have all the answers, and there's no overnight solution to these problems. For me, it would just be to do the, do the bare minimum at least, and read your briefings and be aware of what is happening in your country, so you're not offending those who are already grieving and have lost everything. In terms of climate change, I think he needs to listen to the science. These are climate fires. That's not just my opinion. Science is supporting that. Our chief of the RFS says that himself. He is the man who would know. So I think Scott Morrison needs to be talking to these professionals and starting to make some change that way. We need climate action. There's no overnight solution. I don't think he should have all the answers. But just being willing to listen and learn is where I think he needs to begin, and to acknowledge the suffering of our country. There's been complete denial about, everything from climate change to people's emotions. And he just needs to start acknowledging what is happening in our country and, show some leadership.
Mm. So recently you were at a climate change rally, a climate change protest. So how was the space and the atmosphere during that rally?
It was a phenomenal experience. Thousands of people showed up. There was everyone there from, your greenies to your CFS volunteers, to people who had lost their homes in fires, and even a young girl who had fled from the Bega fires in New South Wales to seek refuge in Adelaide because she's an asthmatic and she couldn't breathe in her state. That's how bad the air quality is. So there were people from all walks of life at this protest. It wasn't just one demographic, which I think is one thing we need to point out, because there's been a lot of critics accusing those of being at the protest as, you know, these hippie types who are just angry and have no idea what they're talking about. But there were experts there, and there were people who have been directly impacted by these fires there. So that's the first thing I want to point out. But yeah, the protest was beautiful. It was great to see everyone coming together for one message. It was peaceful. There were no troubles with the police or anything like that. But it was a chance for us to come together and to talk about what we want as a nation. And I think, for a start, the common theme was some leadership and for some compassion. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the protest was fantastic, and it was so incredible to see thousands of people at Parliament House all coming together, all different walks of life, for the same cause.
Mm-hmm. What specific changes do you hope to see from Australia regarding climate change? Because I guess after COP25, you know, Australia was criticised for its disappointing stance on carbon emissions. So are you hopeful that there will be some changes in the way Australia proceeds in terms of climate change action?
Yeah, I just think we need to start a transition, and I think we need to listen to the experts for a start. And secondly, I think we need to look at where we're investing our money. I'm sure it's all over the news about the fossil fuel industry and where we're investing billions of dollars and what we're supporting. And I think that's what needs the overhaul first. Like I said, it's impossible for Australia to just, you know, completely turn and rely on solar and wind or overnight or something like that. But I think what the Australian public really want is just some acknowledgement of these climate fires and climate change, and the discussions and the starting of this transition away from these industries that have caused so much damage and that we are investing billions of dollars into. And I think as well, on more of a personal level, we need some new systems set in place for our volunteer firefighters. The volunteers that I know personally often are defending, you know, their homes, their family homes, their friends' homes, days on end, and there's no counselling services offered. There's barely any, money to cover what they lose. So I think on that level as well, there needs to be some changes made to that.
Mm-hmm. And with climate changes as one of the factors to the bushfires. I was reading a little bit up on it, and I'm not sure if you can speak on it as well, but there's been some criticism as well that Aboriginal Australians use controlled burning as a way of managing the environment. So is that something that you have knowledge about, that you can talk on?
I won't talk on it too much, but what I will say is that from our First Nations people themselves, they are saying, you know, hazard reduction is a way to stop bushfires. That's true. The problem is that our bushfire season is extending, so the period in which they can actually backburn to do hazard reduction is becoming smaller, and that is a reflection of climate change, and that's coming from our First Nations people and our scientists and our RSS chiefs. That's not just made up bullshit, to be frank. That's the truth. So yes, hazard reduction would help to prevent fires, but we have less time to do that now because our bushfire season is extending because of climate change.
What can we do to support Australia moving forward?
These fires have been massive, obviously, and they're still going, but this is going to ripple into everyday life for a long time to come. So don't forget about us, I think, is the main message. It's great to see all these people donating and sharing it on social media now, but what about in a few months' time? Like, these houses and businesses and lives won't be rebuilt overnight. So we need to seriously consider our long-term support to Australia. Coming and visiting those towns when they're back up and running, investing into the local economy, not investing but supporting the local economy, and just remembering that these fires, once they stop, if they stop, there's going to be impacts for a long time to come. And so don't forget about us, because this has been devastating, and this is the biggest fires we've ever seen in Australia. So this is huge, and yeah, we just really need ongoing support from the world.
Yeah. Was there anything else you wanted to add for today?
Fuck ScoMo.
That was Gemma Finn, who is a freelance writer and journalist from South Australia. You can donate directly to the New South Wales Rural Fire Service, Victoria Fire Service, the Wildlife Rescue, or the WWF Koala Crisis. Well, Deb and I were in Sydney. We also ran into Sydney activist Danny Lum.
Yeah, that was entertaining. So we were walking along the sidewalk in Newtown when we saw this old man with like a placard over him, which had some... I don't know.
Colourful language, yeah, I would say, well, about
Scott
Morrison.
Keep this for all the children listening to our political discussions.
Yeah, but it was great. It was very big picture of Scott Morrison's face and some colourful words, and there were definitely some toots from the cars.
Yeah, a lot of support from the public, understandably.
Yeah. And he also had a little dog named Smarty who handed... Mm, yeah.
Who we held.
He's a character, so if you're ever in Sydney and you run into Danny Lim, definitely
keep an eye out.
For him. Yeah, so we're going to have a little bit of a break, but we'll be back with Deb's piece on Black Lover.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
It's about a man called Garfield Todd. He was a New Zealander from Invercargill, so he came to Zimbabwe as a church missionary way back in the, I think, 1932, and ended up becoming Prime Minister of Zimbabwe in 1953 to 58. So the play is based on, he tried to give power to black people, and other white people were not very happy with that, so he was put under house arrest. So the play is mostly around a day of his life while he's under house arrest, just him and his servant.
And if you had to pick three words to really summarise the themes in this play, how would you describe it? What can audiences expect?
Mainly, it's we're talking of race issues. That's one big major issue that we're looking at here. So we're looking at race, and especially race relations, black and white. I guess that's the main theme, really.
So it sort of looks at Zimbabwe's colonial history and
The history of Zimbabwe. And I guess maybe I'll say history of Zimbabwe and its link to New Zealand as well. That's another issue. Most New Zealanders didn't know that New Zealand and Zimbabwe we had that strong connection. Through this man, that comes out in the play as well.
Okay, yeah, and there are sort of parallels in colonialism between New Zealand and Zimbabwe as well.
Yes.
What does it sort of mean for Zimbabwe that they? How has this colonial history really affected it? Having so many prime ministers, I mean, like Sir Garfield Todd, coming in from overseas.
I think. There were good things and also bad things. Always, there's always something bad, but there was really a good thing as well. So if you look at Garfield Todd, at the time he came, he was really shocked with what was going on in terms of how a small amount of white people, a small group of white people, could suppress at least around 7-8 million people. So for him, it was a bit of a shock. How does it happen? And I guess maybe coming from New Zealand and you know how white New Zealanders and Maoris are, they live together and work together and there's no problem. So he thought that could also work in Africa. So I guess it was a really good thing. And also we had other white prime ministers, I guess. It was all to do with white supremacy, white rule, and all those things, and white power. So in such a situation, obviously, there's so many bad things that happen because there'll be maybe other black people who say, no, that's not right. And obviously, there's so many people end up dying a lot of people in there suffering. There was some kind of slavery as well involved in people working in farms and being slaves in their own land or on their own land. So that was very difficult at that time. But I mean, looking at people like Garfield Todd who try to change that history, that's what's important for us. Yeah,
I read that you would like all New Zealanders to know the Sir Garfield Todd story. Why is this important to you? What drew you to writing this play?
Like I said, I mean, talking to people here, I realised that people were not aware of that history. Not everyone. I think the old school people, New Zealanders, are aware of that history.
Mm.
But, younger generations, they don't know those things. They don't know that history. So it is important to bring it back to life. And so people are aware that there is history between New Zealand and Africa, and it's a very strong bond. And, you know, for example, I visited Garfield Todd's daughter, Judith Todd, and some of the, she was showing me some headlines from newspaper cuttings that she had. They were interesting headlines about how Africa is looking to New Zealand Africans were looking to New Zealand to gain their independence. So I think maybe New Zealand being such a small country, and maybe some people are not aware how influential they were to a group of Africans who looked up to them and saying, this is where we are going to get our independence. These people are going to help us to get our independence. So it is important for New Zealanders to know those things, that they have had such an influence on other people's independence and freedom.
Was it surprising to you to find out that many New Zealanders were sort of unaware of Garfield Todd?
In a way, I was surprised. I think that was the reason I thought I should write a play about it, because I was a little bit surprised that people were not aware. But also, I thought New Zealand is so far away from almost everything, and sometimes it's easy for those things to be missed. It takes maybe the other thing that really surprised me was that I think New Zealanders don't really, I never went to school here, so I don't know how much of New Zealand history is taught in schools. So
some of it, more of it could be taught, definitely. But it's only sort of recently that we've been more properly being taught our own colonial history.
Yeah, I think it's really important for that history to be taught, because people like that who taught people, it would be really interesting for young New Zealanders to know that history. I don't think he was the only, I think there were other people, big names, where people who left the country and made names for themselves and made a difference in the world. So I think that's really important for young people to learn those things in schools.
Yeah. And I saw one of your past plays, Overthrown, was banned in Zimbabwe because it allegedly criticised Mugabe. How do you see your role in politics as a storyteller?
I think I've never been someone that's really upfront in terms of political views or anything. So I found writing being my own way of expressing myself in terms of social injustices and things that I don't think are right. I guess people have different ways to express themselves. So I found my way is through writing and expressing myself that way. So I would love to maybe to do a bit more in terms of bringing up those issues, injustices and everything else, and that's also, you know, coming out in my next play as well that I'm working on. I'll be working on soon. I want to talk a little bit more as well on social injustices and race issues, and because I grew up around that. I grew up a lot around that and seeing the
seen the effects of it.
Yeah, the effect as well. So I think that's what I want to sort of work on it a bit more and say a bit more about it. And the political situation in Africa is always another thing that always been something that I'm passionate about. Especially given that Africa is so rich, and then because of a small group of people, politicians, they are holding the whole continent to ransom because of their own self-interest. So we need to speak out in any way we can. Some people do it through music. Some people will go on the streets. Some people prefer to write plays like myself. So whichever way we can say something, we have to.
Yeah, and so this is important for the Zimbabwean community as well.
Yeah, it is important for the Zimbabwean community. And you also find most of them are here because of political and financial situations in their own homeland. They can't even, some people have been here maybe for 15 years, they haven't been back, and some people came as refugees. They haven't been able to go back to see their families, and they are homesick all the time, and all because of political instability, and it's really sad.
That was playwright Stanley Makuwe speaking about his play Black Lover. And I meant to say this at the start, but that's okay. I'll explain things now.
Sorry, dude.
So the Auckland Theatre Company is staging that play as part of the Auckland Arts Festival this year. And as you hopefully heard during the interview, it tells the story of expat New Zealander Sir Garfield Todd, who became Prime Minister of Rhodesia, now known as Zimbabwe, from 1953 to 1958, and he was called a black lover by his detractors due to his public advocating for racial equality.
That was The Wire.
Koe Te Ao. Wow. Let's just turn that down so I can do the outro. Koe Ra Te Hōtaka Katoa Mō Tēnei Wiki. That brings us to the end of our show for another week. Nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki o mō tēnei rā. A big thanks to all those who spoke with us for the show today, James Shaw, Gemma Finn and Stanley Makawe. And thank you so much for Deb for producing. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thank you to all those who've tuned in. Ka hoki mātou e te tera wiki. We'll be back next week, next Monday. Up next we've got Penny with the 1-4. Kei te whakarongo koe ki te irarangi pōho. You're listening to 95BFM.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.